Good Monday, everybody. Welcome into the Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming live on the Game Nashville app as well. How's it going? Chase McCabe, Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson is at the Wholesaling Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. Gentlemen, the last dance is in the books. Ryan, good morning. What's up?
What's up, Chaser? How are you?
Oh, I'm feeling good. Yesterday was a good day for me. NASCAR's back. Kevin Harvick gets the win. It was a fun race. And then I capped it off by watching the final two episodes of The Last Dance. So I'm feeling good to start the week.
The Last Dance was pretty amazing.
It was. It was very well done. I wasn't sure. I remember the first time that I saw a preview for this. This is before the pandemic, before everything, when it was originally supposed to be released in June. I was sitting in the studio. I was doing the midday show. And I saw this, you know, it was like Everybody's Talks or something. That was the promo that they put together. And they showed the preview of The Last Dance. And I remember when I saw that, I was thinking, okay, well, I know what I'm doing in June. This is going to be awesome because everyone, you know, loved those Bulls teams. And there are a lot of unanswered questions of why they broke up and, you know, why they didn't go for it. And so I was really looking forward to it. It exceeded my expectations. It was very well done. Jason Eyre, the director, should be very, very proud of himself for the job that he did and the documentary that he pulled off.
Marquise, let's hear your reaction because I'm going to have to go stop the Roomba that just started unexpectedly.
Yeah, I was wondering what that was.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I thought it was a technical difficulty or something.
You're going to have to give me about 20 seconds.
But, no, I mean, I enjoyed it. As a basketball fan, like, this is probably, and I know I said this on Twitter and people were like, oh, you're just recency bias when you say that. I did not think by watching the OJ Made in America documentary, nothing was even going to get close to that because that documentary was just so amazingly well put. Yep. And it won an Oscar. But I watched this, and as a basketball fan, I was a lot more invested in this than I was on the OJ documentary. Because when I saw the previews of this Jordan thing, my basketball senses was tingling. And yeah. I was just like, this is going to be amazing. I'm going to, like, because Jordan's been such this, he's like Prince. Like, people know a lot about Prince, but Prince still has this aura around him to where you don't know too much about his personal life. And this is it. Like, this is Jordan in its rare form that you've never seen before. So as a basketball fan, I was excited, and it lived up to every expectation I had for it back in January when I started seeing it. So
I would agree with you, Marquise, about being a lot more invested in this documentary than OJ Made in America. And it really wasn't even close. And the reporting and all the footage of that OJ documentary, it was phenomenal. But, I mean, we're talking about one of the greatest dynasties in sports history, and an athlete that is larger than life with Michael Jordan, where you don't ever really get access to MJ. MJ does not give access to just anybody. And the amount of access that he gave Jason Eyre and his crew was phenomenal. I thought this was a very well done documentary. You got to see, you know, everything that was going on, not just in 97-98, but that entire run once Michael Jordan stepped foot in Chicago. I thought it was just fantastic. And sometime down the road, I'll probably binge watch all 10 in a row just to watch all 10 in a row. We only saw two at a time. You know, if there's ever a gloomy Sunday where we don't really have anything to do, I think I will end up binge watching all of them.
Well, I did that yesterday. I just watched them all again. So I did all day yesterday. It was just me, like, in my sweatpants watching The Last Dance until the last episode.
I'll probably do the same. But looking at the last two episodes specifically, you know, some takeaways, some things that we saw. I'll say this, and Marquise, you and I were texting a little bit during it. I forgot how good those Pacers teams, or that Pacer team was, that we saw in the Eastern Conference Final. I mean, Reggie Miller is regarded as one of the best players, you know, of his era, but I don't know if he gets the credit that he deserves. Those Pacer teams, coached by Larry Bird, were a lot of fun to watch, and that was a heck of a series that they depicted in episode 9 of The Last Dance.
I would agree with that. And I thought it was cool not only with the Pacer series but the Jazz series as well, where MJ and Larry Bird or MJ and Reggie Miller or MJ and Karl Malone, they would all show respect for one another in the event level of United Center or wherever they were playing. And Karl Malone going on the bus after the Bulls win in 98, going on the Bulls team bus and congratulating them. I thought that was just really, really interesting because I was surprised that Karl Malone.
I don't feel like you see that nowadays.
No, not at all. I mean, I was surprised that Karl Malone was not featured in that documentary. I was a little surprised that it was John Stockton essentially representing that Jazz team.
Well, apparently John Stockton wasn't even going to do it at first. Like, none of the Jazz players were. Apparently that interview with John Stockton was done in like March that I looked up. None of them wanted to do it.
I'll say this, that's poor form on Karl Malone. I really think it is. I mean, Karl Malone should have been in this. I don't know his reasoning. He might say it. He might not. You know, I don't really know how much Karl Malone has done since his playing career. I mean, he's one that I don't think you really see. But that was one of the first things that I was thinking about when they were showing that first series against the Jazz. I'm like, where's Malone?
I know.
Why isn't Malone in this?
Well, and, you know, Isaiah Thomas was featured in it at one time. Charles Barkley, Reggie Miller, Gary Payton. I mean, I really was surprised that
Patrick
Malone.
Ewing?
Yes. I was surprised that Malone opted not to do it.
I'm not going to sit here and blast him like, oh, you know, shame on him for not doing it. He loses two finals. Like, what a poor sport. I'm not going to do that. But I am like, really, why isn't he in this? I mean, he should have done something with it.
So a couple more observations that I had last night. First of all, I enjoyed just watching the basketball between the Bulls and the Pacers in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Final and then the two NBA Finals against the Jazz. And there wasn't a whole lot of jumping around. It was just some of the more memorable series that the Bulls played in the postseason with MJ. So I really enjoyed that. Also, we've heard in recent years Steve Kerr be very outspoken about gun violence. And I think last night shed a lot of light on why he may feel that way. You know, the story of his father.
I had no idea.
Yeah, exactly. The story of his father being murdered in Beirut was really hard to watch both Steve Kerr and his mother reflect on that moment in their life. And the sheer production of this thing was a 10 out of 10. And one small reason why I'm saying the production of the entire docuseries is a 10 out of 10 is last night I loved that immediately after Steve Kerr mentioned in the interview that he thinks of his dad during the national anthem.
Yep.
They have the footage of Steve Kerr standing on the court during the anthem in the next game of the documentary's timeline in the 97 NBA Finals. I thought that was very, very well done.
So I didn't know about Steve Kerr's dad. I'll just full disclosure. If you did, then, you know, more power
to
you. But I didn't. I had no idea that was even a thing. And I thought how Steve Kerr was featured and depicted throughout the whole documentary was well done, because Steve Kerr is a guy that so many people have a lot of respect for, and he was a big part of all those teams, those championships. And you may forget he's won three championships as a head coach, but he won five as a player with the Bulls and the Spurs. So, I mean, he's quite accomplished as a player.
Well, you mentioned now as a coach with Golden State, do we feel like Golden State would have had the run that they had if Steve Kerr wasn't their head coach? I mean, Steve Kerr lived through the dynasty in the 90s with the Bulls. He saw Phil Jackson handle all those big personalities. And Steve Kerr had to do a lot of the same things with Draymond Green, with KD, with Steph Curry, with Klay Thompson. I have a little bit more respect for Steve Kerr out of last night's episodes. His totality, both as a player and a coach.
I do too. I do believe that, number one, and I know this is a bit of a cop-out cliche answer, but it's true. It's a different era. I mean, they played defense back in the 90s. They don't play defense anymore. It's very apparent. And the Bulls had Jordan, who was in a league of his own, and then you had Pippen that was close behind, but Pippen was still the number two. And then you had Rodman and then the rest and then the fall off. Golden State, with Steve Kerr, I mean, he had, you just mentioned Steph and Draymond and then later KD. I mean, he had a little bit more talent overall through the team was deeper, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But again, different era. So
he may not have had all the drama to deal with that Phil Jackson had to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, there was so much behind the scenes. So that was one, you know, that with Steve Kerr that I really enjoyed all of that. But, you know, to mention the showing the national anthem, you know, one thing that you and I learned early on in producing with Jeremy Benefield when he was here, he taught us about ear candy, that you have to do those little things that will catch somebody's attention, but, you know, make the bump music relevant to what you're talking about. You know, have a whatever clip that's relevant to whatever you're talking about, those types of things. So I thought about that when I was watching it if I was producing this, I probably would have done the same thing. Okay, I need to find video of Steve Kerr standing there with the anthem. That so the production value there was awesome.
Here's another thing that I loved about it, and this is more of a personal thing, but when I was a kid, I got Sports Illustrated for Kids on a monthly basis. However often they sent out SI for Kids, I was getting every single magazine. And I always remembered that they had, like, in the middle pages, they had a little poster that you could take out of the magazine. And one of those posters one time was immediately after the NBA Finals, the iconic photo of Jordan's last shot and the faces in the crowd behind the basket in Utah. And I was like a little kid again looking at the faces, because I did that when I was 8 or 9 years old when I first saw that photo. I would just stare at the different photo or the different faces behind the basket. And they zoomed in on the photo last night and moved it around, and I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that was neat. I thought that was well done. Of course, I have to bring up because I've been waiting for it with Dennis Rodman. They showed him with Hulk Hogan on WCW Nitro. And we're actually going to effort getting Eric Bischoff on, who was the head of WCW at the time, because I want to know more about how that all came to be. And it's in the middle of the finals, and, you know, they're showing the practice or the press conference after the practice. And Phil, you can tell that Phil is agitated that he's having to cover because he didn't know about it. And Rodman just doing Rodman's thing, but it didn't affect him on the court. It just what? And the other thing too, the behind the scenes of the PR guy trying to sneak him out.
Yeah,
because, you know, we've all been on the other side of that. Of we're trying to wait for somebody, and you know that they don't want to talk, and so they're trying to sneak him out.
Yeah,
and you know, you have your plan, you have the exits covered, but that was so fantastic. And I was laughing at that.
And a fun fact for everyone, because me and Chase were texting about this yesterday, that the guy that Dennis Rodman hit with the chair, Diamond Dallas Page, would end up teaming up with Karl Malone at a pay-per-view. Yep. So it was Karl Malone and Diamond Dallas Page, DDP, versus Hulk Hogan and Dennis Rodman in 98.
I want to know if this is the answer or not, because the clip that they showed of Karl Malone and Rodman jostling with each other on the court, if I know Eric Bischoff like I think I do, my guess is he got the idea right there. Okay, I need Malone. Malone's got to be a part of this, because there's something here. So I want to find out the answer to that question.
So I'm going to ask you a question after the break, Chase.
Okay.
And that question is, do you believe the pizza story?
Well, you read my mind, because we're going to talk about the pizza story. And so I will answer that question and much more here on The Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Tune in this Friday at noon for Game 6 Remastered, chronicling the Predators' historic 2017 Western Conference title win against the Anaheim Ducks. You'll hear Pete Weber's call of the biggest moments of Game 6, an exclusive insight into the Predators' memorable playoff run from the individuals that lived it. That's Game 6 Remastered this Friday at noon on ESPN 102.5 The Game and the Game Nashville app. You got to give it some oomph, Ryan. I mean, it remastered. I mean, it's not just Game 6. It's Game 6 Remastered. Yeah, so you got to throw that in there. Very well done by you. We're excited about this and what it's going to sound like starting Friday at noon. But we continue the Last Dance, and the series wraps up last night with episodes 9 and 10. And, of course, we knew that there was one iconic story from that run, from those days of Jordan and the Bulls, that needed some clarification. The flu game, as it was always referred to. And he tells the story of being in Utah and goes into it. So instead of me setting it up, here's Michael Jordan from The Last Dance talking about the pizza story.
The night before the game, we were all in Michael's room hanging out.
But it's like 10, 10:30 at night. I'm hungry.
No room service. Michael gets hungry. So, all right, so we're calling all these different places. George and I are looking around. We find one pizza place open. One.
So he ordered a pizza. And when the pizza came, there was four or five guys outside the door.
Five guys delivering one pizza.
You know, it's very rare that you get five delivery guys from, you know, the pizza place to bring you your pizza.
And they're all trying to look in, and, you know, everybody knew it was my... So I take the pizza, I pay them, and I put this pizza down. And I said, I got a bad feeling about this.
I eat the pizza all by myself. Nobody else eats it. Eat the pizza. I wake up about 2:30, throwing up left and right.
3 o'clock in the morning, I get a call. My room, hey, man, come to your room right now. All right, I get into him. He's literally curled up in a ball, shaking. He goes, man, find a team doc now.
So it really wasn't a flu game. It was food poisoning.
Michael Jordan and his trainer, everybody else that was involved in that. So five people deliver a pizza. That's the first thing that stood out to me. Okay, well, you obviously know who's in the room. So you got the delivery guy and his buddies trying to get a sneak peek of Michael Jordan. Now you have this iconic story that for years has been he's got the flu. He's got flu-like symptoms. It's the flu game. It's this amazing performance by Michael Jordan. Now he does this documentary and he says, no, it was a pizza. It was food poisoning. On top of the rumors that have always been there for years, you know, similar to the suspension for gambling, going to play baseball, that he was just hung over. So you are going to ask me if I believe the story, right?
Yes. Chase McCabe, do you believe that story as it was told last night on The Last Dance?
Hell no. I don't believe that story. It's way too perfect how they told it. That, you know, you clearly have everybody on the same page, and it's just way too perfect. Now, if he was hungover, if that's really what it was, I don't care. He still played a hell of a game, and he always did that. Like, I am sure that there were times where Michael Jordan, or anyone else for that matter, got drunk the night before a game, and as long as they went out and still performed, I don't care. That doesn't bother me. Whatever. You do you. I couldn't do that, but let's be honest, stone cold sober, I couldn't do some of the things he did. So, So I could maybe dribble down the court once. Who knows? But
you would look like Phyllis in The Office trying to dribble a basketball down the court.
You know,
or no, not Phyllis. It was Stanley.
Sometimes, you know, I just need to make the joke and just move on. I don't need any comments from the peanut gallery.
Move on.
But. I don't believe it. It's way too rehearsed. It's way too perfect. It goes back into the storyline of how much control did Jordan have over this, but whatever. I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Do you believe it?
I don't think I believe it. I don't think I do, because how – all right, so his trainer and his personal friend are the two that are said to be in the room with MJ, right? Like it –
right.
Those two were with him when they ordered the pizza, and they did not want to eat the pizza because of five guys standing outside with the delivery, right? So why, if you're the trainer or the personal friend,
don't let him eat it.
How would the pizza delivery guys know that that's MJ's room? Like, if if they ordered the pizza for Michael and they said, yeah, this is Michael Jordan's room, and you are in Utah when you do this, you are asking for what actually happened within that story, whether it's true or not.
Yeah, that's like, why it just doesn't make sense.
If they were smart about it, they would have said, oh, yeah, it's for I forget who the trainer's name was. But you could say, you know, Bob Smith, this pizza's for Bob Smith, and you don't have five pizza delivery guys coming knocking on your door. If that story is legit. So I don't know if I truly believe it. It's funny that we depicted that as the flu game for years, and now it's the food poisoning game.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So
it just doesn't have the same ring to it.
But it's still an iconic thing that happened. And, you know, when he said, I have a bad feeling about this, what? How do you have a bad feeling about this? It's a pizza. Like, okay, five guys showed up. And who knows? Like, to your point, use a fake name or have one of the other guys order it. But at the same time, and I don't know what information was out there during that era. I mean, you can find out that it's the team hotel. I mean, I know today you can. Like, people know. I see hockey fans lined up outside whatever hotel the opposing team is staying at trying to get a picture or an autograph because they find this stuff out. So, whatever. But it's still made for a good story, and now we have a little more clarifications. But as we work our way through these last two episodes, and really the theme of the whole series, the question on everybody's mind is and will always be, could they have run it back and won 7? Could they have won? Could they have completed the four-peat with this team? And that, I think, will always be something that we wonder about. Because, and as I've heard many, I was watching SVP last night, listening to Golic and Wingo earlier. It was a 50-game season. So with all the other underlying things, Pippen's unhappy, Jordan's exhausted, you know, Phil is mentally done. There's tension between Krause and Phil Jackson. It was a shortened season, so the path would have been a little bit easier than the others. Could they have run it back? Michael Jordan, during the Last Dance, says everyone would have signed a one-year deal and come back.
If you ask all the guys who won in 98, Steve Kerr, Jeff Busler, blah, 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 we give you a one-year contract to try for 7. You think they would have signed? Yes, they would have signed. Would I sign for 1 year? Yes, I would have signed for 1 year. I've been signing 1 year contracts up to that. Would Phil done it? Yes. Now, Pip, you would have to do some convincing, but if Phil was going to be there, if Dennis was going to be there, if MJ was going to be there to win a 7th, Pip is not going to miss on out on that.
Michael Jordan, if they would sign 1 year deals. I don't know if I agree with him. I don't know if Pip would have resigned. I think at that point the damage had been done and was irreparable.
Well, it was clear that Phil Jackson wasn't going to come back.
Yeah, that's another part too, which Phil said that. Phil was like, that would have been, you know, because Jerry Reinsdorf tried at that point. He was going to
That was half-hearted. He did not try. That was half-hearted.
You come out
publicly the year before and you're saying this is the last dance. Phil is not coming back. We've got Tim Floyd waiting in the wings.
Krause said that.
Okay, but and then you win number 6, and it's like, oh, well, Phil, if you want to come back, you know, you can. And at that point, to use your words, the damage was done. It wasn't going to happen with
Phil.
Yeah,
because nobody believed that they would actually win a 6th. That's the problem. Krause thought it was done. Reinsdorf, here's a big takeaway from this whole thing, Ryan, that Jerry Reinsdorf is a multi-millionaire, billionaire, I don't even know, has a lot of success as an owner, but he's an idiot and he's oblivious on some things because he's just sitting there listening to his GM. He's not paying attention to what's going on, which I guess some owners are just that way. They're just, you know, whatever, I'm going to count my money and enjoy some basketball. But he had no idea some of the things going on or just chose not to. And so, yeah, you're right. It was half-hearted because it was just too late. He's like, oh, okay. They mm-hmm. won a 6. All of a sudden, they're good enough to do it. All right, sure. Let's bring everybody back. We'll do it one more time. That's just being oblivious. But the damage was done.
If they had come back, though, let's just hypothetically say that what MJ is saying there is true, and they all would have come back for one more year to go for number 7. Do you think they would have won?
No.
Why?
I don't. Well, why? Because the Pacers were better. So
no.
You knew they were coming back.
No, they weren't.
They ended up finishing second in the East.
Okay, well, they won 33 games, which in an 82-game season would have been a 54-win season.
Okay, Miami also
only had 33 wins, which would have been a 54-win season. In 98-99, there weren't any super great teams.
I will say this. The only real good team was the Spurs, who end up winning the whole thing because David Robinson was going on his last year and Tim Duncan was like an emerging star. That's like the only team that you can make an argument that could compete with the – and Allen Iverson was still young with the 76ers, so it wouldn't have been that. And then the Pacers, that probably would have been a good series to watch. Miami was good, but they weren't that good.
Yeah, the Bulls still would have been the NBA's best team.
I think they would have gotten out of the – what I was leading up to is I think they would have gotten out of the East. But to what Marquise just said, I don't know if they beat the Spurs.
Why?
Because Tim Duncan's an emerging star. You have the Admiral that is trying to go out with a bang. That was a loaded team. Now, one thing that and Steve Kerr wasn't a huge, you know, he was a role player. That's what he was. But do you have all those role players back with the Bulls? Or do you have to, because I've heard other people say, well, if Steve Kerr leaves or whatever, you know, you just replace him with another veteran role player. Does that work?
Well, the question, how I just put it was how MJ put it.
So everybody's back.
Everybody's back on one of your deals. I 1,000% am convinced that the Bulls would have won it in 98-99. 1,000%.
It's just hard because every team that's been dominant or at least competing with the Bulls on a level had – Their star player was a guard or a small forward, somebody that Pippen or Rodman or Jordan can guard. You don't really got guys on that team that can guard Tim Duncan and David Robinson.
You're missing
There just wasn't.
You're also missing one very key point in all of this. Because under this scenario, this is how Jordan laid it out, that they've won six at this point. You get everybody in a room and like, okay, you know what? Let's go for seven. Let's Phil's in. Get everybody in. Everybody's back. But the bad blood's still there. You're not just washing that away because you know in the back of your mind you're thinking, this is not what Jerry Krause wants. Jerry Krause wants us all gone. Jerry Krause hates Phil. Phil hates Jerry. Jerry and Pip hate each other. Jordan's got, you know, bad blood with Jerry.
But they put that aside for 97-98.
They already did it once. You're going to ask them to do it again? Do you think that they
in
really can do it
again? In a
lockout
shortened season, yes. That dynasty was still in its prime. Even though MJ was going to be 36 that season, he averaged over 32 points per game in the 98 playoffs. I think that they – also, MJ was driven by his own greatness. He was driven by the critics. You can't
MJ
tell me that
was.
You cannot tell me that he would not have been just over his heels to go for number seven where Bill Russell has that record. And he could have tied Bill Russell – and shared that record with him. You cannot tell me that they wouldn't have at least, met the number seven.
But you're looking at it from just Michael's eyes. You're not factoring in everybody else. You really think that with everything that was depicted with Scottie Pippen and Jerry Krause, that he's just going to all of a sudden be like, yeah, sure, I'll play second fiddle one more time and try and win seven?
Under MJ's conditions that he laid out, yes.
I just don't. I don't feel that way. I respect your opinion, but I don't feel that way.
There weren't any great teams in the 98-99 season. I get Duncan and David Robinson were a fantastic 1-2 duo. They ended up winning the title. But they would have been the number one team in the NBA once again in 98-99. Lockout shortened season, they wouldn't have had, you know, to go through an 82-game season again. You could mask a lot of those different – they did it for 97-98. There's no reason why they couldn't have done it one more year, especially with all those players in their prime.
You just don't know, and I don't know either. I don't pretend to know just how bad the feelings were. And you're asking human beings, because we forget sometimes that they're human beings, to put that aside yet again and with it building. I don't know. We'll never know. We'll never know because
– we won't.
Because it got blown up, and the next year the Bulls finished last. I think they won 13 games. And so they blew it up.
They were the worst team for the next 5 years.
Yeah, because they did what Krause wanted to do. They did a rebuild.
Yeah.
So that's how it ends. When we come back, though, our biggest takeaways from the entire documentary. We've hit on it a little bit, but a couple of things that stood out to us. We'll do that next. The rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Help us decide who... Oh, man, I want to do this so bad. Help us decide who you think has the best hockey jersey in our uniform drawing contest. The winner will receive a personalized Nashville Predators jersey courtesy of the Nashville Predators. You can vote at the 102.5 The Game Twitter page or the Game Nashville Facebook page. Cast your vote now. Ah, this is so good. And now, our takeaways for The Last Dance, Ryan. The entire Last Dance, not just episodes 9 and 10, but the full documentary that wrapped up last night. And ESPN, how about this? ESPN's going to show Game 6, the movie is what they're calling it, but Jordan's, what would turn out to be Jordan's last game at the time, before the Wizards come back. They're going to show that on Wednesday, so I'm going to be watching NASCAR and have to flip back and forth and watch some of that, because that'll be pretty cool. But some things that stood out to you for the entire documentary, what you got?
All right, so I've got five takeaways from the docuseries as a whole. Not in any sort of order, really, but here were my five biggest takeaways. Maverick, get out of here.
That's one.
All right, so yes, number one. Michael Jordan was human. You know, he's this larger-than-life athlete that spans generations. You think of him as, you know, as he put it himself to Reggie Miller, as, you know, a black Jesus. You think of him as this invincible human being, but it was so obvious throughout this that MJ was human, just like all of us. You know, he had personal relationships with the security guards, and Gus becomes a father figure to him. You know, he showed a lot of emotion in the documentary of him being ultra competitive with his teammates and crossing lines at times. Showed a lot of emotion then and now about losing his father. He listened to the critics. He listened to the doubters. He holds grudges against opponents, and he was fueled by all of it. And, you know, MJ said before this documentary aired that a lot of people were going to think he's a bad guy or hated him more. And I don't think of him any less out of this documentary. If anything, I appreciate him more.
Yeah.
So for me, that was my number one takeaway.
Let me respond on that. Because
go for it.
Because you're spot on. That was one that I had. And in how I worded it, this is how I wrote it down. With everything that he accomplished, 6 championships, 5 MVPs, all of that, Hall of Fame career, something that you should sit there and just say, man, I dominated. He's still pissed off that Jerry Krause blew up the team. Like, he still to this day holds that grudge, and he hasn't gotten over it, and he's never going to get over it. And we know, I mean, we've met athletes that they hold on to things. I mean, we all know one in particular that holds on to things. Jordan's that guy. And that's what drove him. I mean, there are still – Isaiah Thomas still doesn't like Isaiah Thomas. He's still mad at Jerry Reinsdorf for letting it all blow up.
Sure.
I mean, he just holds on to that. And I love that competitive side of him. I think that that's what made him the player that he was. But, you know, I thought, okay, maybe if this goes on, you know, they'll talk about that. Jerry Reinsdorf and Michael have talked, or, you know, Krause and Jordan made up before Krause died. Nope. He still holds on to it.
Sure.
And so that was one thing that stood out.
Yeah, absolutely. My second takeaway was just the drama between the front office and the players and Phil Jackson. You know, I was 8 years old. That probably meant you would have been, what, 10 years old when all of this went on? And
yep.
At the time, at my age, I didn't understand the front office drama that was going on with Phil Jackson and the players themselves. Didn't know that the front office was so set on the 97-98 season being the, quote, last dance. So just learning about all of that, I thought was fascinating. So that would have been my second takeaway.
Yeah, and Jerry Krause, and so many people have said throughout this that he got credit, he deserves more credit. I mean, the players even said that in The Last Dance. I mean, you know, in so many words, Jordan acknowledged that he put it together, and Pippen acknowledged that. But it just showed you how jealous Jerry Krause was of Phil Jackson, of Michael Jordan, of everybody that was basically viewed on the front lines, and they were in front of the camera, and he's a behind the scenes guy. He couldn't handle it. That he was the one, and he was. I mean, he was the architect. He's the GM. He's the guy that got Pippen to sign that contract and got these role players and put the whole team together. And it was almost like that he was so determined that that was the last year, that that was the last dance, because he had that power. Then he could say, nope, I made it. I can end it. It's done.
See, here's the thing, and that leads me to my number three takeaway, is that as much as Krause was cast as the villain in management, I put as much blame or even more on Jerry Reinsdorf. I thought Jerry Reinsdorf got off way too easy in this documentary, and maybe MJ didn't approach Reinsdorf the way they all did with Krause, because Reinsdorf is a fellow owner of his in the NBA. Reinsdorf gave him the opportunity to play baseball with the White Sox organization. Maybe he has a soft spot in his heart for Reinsdorf, like he may not have for Jerry Krause. So I would say my third takeaway is that Reinsdorf got off way too easy through this documentary. The fact that Reinsdorf did not want to pay those players again is the biggest reason why that thing came to an end.
Yeah, he definitely came off at times as the I'm not going to say the cheap owner, but you know, he just didn't want to spend a lot of money, and he was gonna milk it for all he could, and they were all underpaid at that point, and especially to today's standards, but they were all underpaid, but he got six championships out of it. So yeah, but I agree.
My number four takeaway is I don't think the Bulls would have survived the media landscape in 2020.
Oh.
I mean, they were like the Beatles. There was all the drama between the players and the front office and management. You know, you have Dennis Rodman going AWOL multiple times within this documentary, and who knows how many other times that those things happened with Rodman. And you could tell in 93, the third year of the first three-peat, and in 98, the second three-peat, that those seasons took a lot of toll on those teams just internally. So you put that situation in 2020 with social media, with media as a whole, I don't know if they have the same amount of success or would have lasted together as long in today's landscape.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean, that the media, social media, everything has changed how a lot of that's done, because you could mask a many things. I mean, you could keep stuff behind the scenes, and now you can't.
Sure.
So that's a good one. Go ahead with your last one.
So my last takeaway is that I have a much better appreciation for the NBA in the 90s. That was the NBA's heyday. I certainly appreciate today's NBA, but there are the fact that free agency wasn't as prevalent back then meant that these teams were sticking together, and you didn't have a bunch of individuals on teams. You had actual teams, and there were a lot of good ones. And you know, you also had a lot of great talent. You had Reggie Miller, you had Karl Malone and John Stockton in Utah, you had Charles Barkley, you had Patrick Ewing, Magic Johnson, the Bad Boys, Shaq and Penny in Orlando, on top of the greatest dynasty in NBA, or one of the greatest dynasties in NBA history. So, you know, the Dream Team scrimmage footage was one of my favorite parts of the entire documentary. And you had a lot of great teams that never won an NBA title because of that Bulls dynasty. And, you know, even though the jerseys were mostly bad and the final scores were end of third quarter scores in today's NBA, I would say the 90s NBA was as good as it gets for the NBA.
Yeah, defense is cool, kids. I'm just saying. Defense is all right. Some great defensive players in that era. So those are very good. Some of the biggest things for me, I loved how we got to learn more about Jordan and his dad and their relationship. And like I said, the Steve Kerr thing, I had no idea. I didn't know about Steve Kerr's dad at all. So I liked how they were able to tie those two things together. I was curious of why, and I know that his ex-wife didn't really do a lot of media anyway before. I mean, you didn't know much about her when they were together, but I did kind of think that she might have been in this, and she wasn't. The kids were in the last episode for just a couple seconds, really. They weren't in it very long. So that shows you that I think his control, that he's always been that way with them, that they haven't been featured in a lot of things. But I was curious, you know, I wanted to know a little bit more about the family side of MJ. So that's something, because Ben asked us, in y'all's opinion, was anything missing, or did you wish that there was something in there? That's on the text line, 615-737-1025, your biggest takeaway of The Last Dance. So those were some things. I'm glad that there was some clarification to the baseball story, that it wasn't a suspension, that you actually had David Stern saying it's ridiculous. He quit to go play baseball, or he retired. That's really what he did. There wasn't some top secret suspension. So, and then you covered a lot of the other things that I had as my takeaways. And Marquise, I know you have one as well.
You guys are missing the main point of this whole documentary.
Right? Uh-oh.
The whole point.
Go ahead.
Poor Scott Burrell, man. Poor Scott Burrell. That guy, man. Look, he may never get another recruit at Southern Kentucky or Connecticut ever again because of this documentary, man. Poor Scott Burrell.
Or you might get them all.
Punishment in this whole documentary. Just picking on Scott Burrell. Poor Scott Burrell. Make that a t-shirt, please. Poor Scott Burrell. Man, I just felt bad for him every episode. Jordan putting his dirty laundry out, he cussing at him at practice. He didn't do that to nobody else. He just did it to Scott Burrell, man.
Last night after they won number six, he was basically telling Scott, don't ever, he was, you know, jerking his chain and, don't ever call me again unless we're on the same team.
I would have laughed if they ended the documentary, but they were playing like Pearl Jam present tense, and he's smoking a cigar looking out the window, and he just says one final thing about Scott Burrell. That would have been the greatest closing of any documentary of all time.
Well, it was well done. Hey, poor Scott Burrell, but he might get recruits. Man, you were picked on by MJ. Okay, I'll come play for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Who knows? It could work in his favor. But there you go. The Last Dance, our final takeaways. I'm sure that we'll all be binge watching it here in the near future, because now what do we do? I mean, there's some good 30 for 30s that are coming up, though. I'm curious about the Lance Armstrong one and the
nothing to this level, though.
No, but you know, Sosa and McGuire should be interesting.
The Bruce Lee.
Yeah, that'll be good. And then Wednesday night, they'll show Game 6, the movie, doing an in-depth look at that game, the final game of that Bulls dynasty. So there you go. But there's a sport that made its return yesterday. I'll give you my thoughts. We'll talk a little NASCAR and also the NHL when we come back. The Rundown, ESPN 1025 The Game. Let's try this again. Do you own or manage a small business, not smanage? Are you open and want to let people know about that? Then Free Business Friday on ESPN 1025 The Game is for you. This Friday, we're offering free advertising to local businesses that are safely open and working. This is a no-cost, no-catch offer. Visit thegamenashville.com/FBF for more information. Free Business Friday is our way of supporting small businesses as we get through this together. From your friends at ESPN 1025 The Game. Welcome back into The Rundown. Chase McCabe, Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson with you. Ryan, I was just looking during the break at at the top three hockey jerseys that people can vote on at our Twitter page and our Facebook page.
Yes.
Whoever made number two, the party throwback jersey, that's fantastic. I saw that because, you know, I remember the days when this station was 1025 The Party. And I used to listen all the time. And when I saw that, I was like, okay, that's somebody that's been in Nashville for a while.
Yes.
That is awesome. So,
well, and the number on the back is 11, which 2011 was when the change from the party to the game happened.
Yeah. So very, very good. And I like all the designs, but that one popped out to me because I was like, man, somebody remembers the party. I like it. So very, very cool. You can vote now at our, Facebook page and our Twitter page. So yesterday was a big day for me, Ryan. I was very excited because NASCAR, well, it's back officially. The Real Heroes 400 at the Darlington Raceway. I was very curious about a lot of things. You know, number one, the biggest, what it was going to be like without fans. And yeah, they were, I miss the fans being there, but you always hear the engines. You don't really hear the crowd all that much. So I was more focused on the track. It was weird post-race when Kevin Harvick won his 50th Cup win. He breaks the tie with Tony Stewart, moves to 12th all-time on the wins list. So that was weird because he got out of the car on the front stretch and there were no fans. So he's doing the interview with Regan Smith and nobody's there cheering. So that was weird. All the drivers were wearing masks on pit road. Harvick didn't have it on in the car, obviously had the helmet on, but got out. And how they did interviews is Regan Smith, the reporter, who's also a driver, is holding a mic, and then they have another person with a boom mic for the driver. So they weren't actually in contact with each other. They were keeping 6 feet apart to do interviews. So that was interesting of how they did that. So those were a couple of takeaways. The racing was awesome. I thought it was a good race. I was curious of how many people were watching. I did a poll, and most of you said that you didn't watch. We'll see what the ratings say nationally, that if people were tuning in. But I do believe that there are a lot of people that don't watch NASCAR that were able to check it out. But real quick, here's Kevin Harvick, the race winner, on what the atmosphere was like.
Yeah, I think everybody's excited about being back, but there's still that awkwardness of not wanting to screw anything up. So we didn't really want to communicate closely or do anything that might look wrong, because I think today's message was really important to be able to make sure it was sent correctly. So I know everybody, we've all talked about it before we got in the car today, just about how excited we are to be back at the racetrack and be able to, even if we're just talking to each other on the radio, at least we're at the racetrack performing and doing what we love to do.
Kevin Harvick, the race winner, on what it was like and what to expect. I mean, like I said last week, Ryan, they're going to probably have to adjust a few things. NASCAR did send a message to the spotters. And for those of you that don't know what a spotter is, that's the person that's way up top, has the binoculars, and they're talking to a driver and they're saying, hey, you got a car inside or outside. NASCAR told them, you're too close together. You need to move apart and practice social distancing a little bit better. So that did happen during the race. But did you watch any of it?
I did not have an opportunity to watch any of it yesterday. I was at the station putting together Game 6 Remastered, so was not able to see any of it. But by all accounts, it was a great success for NASCAR.
Yes, and they will do it again, the Xfinity Series, tomorrow night, and then the Cup Series will do it again from Darlington Wednesday night on FS1. So seven races in 11 days, and Kyle Busch is running all of them because that's just what Kyle Busch does. That's not really out of the ordinary for him because he runs all the races. Unfortunately, we didn't get to the NHL and the 2014 playoff gaining momentum, but we're going to discuss that a lot on Darren Donick and Chase. For Ryan Porth, for Marquise Munson, I am Chase McCabe. Stay tuned. Darren Donick and Chase is next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.